Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Readiness Report with me, Ready Kabi, and the Daily Maverick. It's been a while, but a lot has been happening. So it's a Tuesday morning. I think it's important that I say that because Tuesday has taken on some ominous meaning. Donald Trump posted a tweet response on his social, Truth Social, whatever, giving Iran until Tuesday to do what he wants or else. And he was talking the language of war, the language of destruction, the language that closes the space for any diplomacy. And he posted this. I'm going to read it. It's coming up now. Tuesday will be power plant day and bridge day, all wrapped up in one in Iran. There will be nothing like it. Open the fucking street, you crazy bastards, or you'll be living in hell. Just watch. Praise be to Allah, President Donald J. Trump. I mean, the garbage that this constitutes. You think that would get worse? You think it can't get worse? It got worse right this morning, Tuesday morning in DC. This particular post has just created such a storm. There are even calls for impeachment. But as I said to one Republican strategist that I spoke to a couple of minutes ago, I don't see that the environment is ripe and right for that to happen. I don't think it will be successful because they're all too scared of him. They're too chicken to call him out. And this nonsense that he's just joking or it's just innocuous, let's move on. This is about diplomacy. This is about life and death, war, you name it. But here's the latest crazy, crazy post. It's real, it's verified, it's making news all over the world. And he posted this: the whole civilization will die tonight, never to be brought back again. I don't want that to happen, but it will probably. However, now that we have complete and total regime change, where different, smarter, and less radicalized minds prevail, maybe something revolutionary, wonderful can happen. Who knows? We will find out tonight, one of the most important moments in the long and complex history of the world. 47 years of extortion, corruption, and death will finally end. God bless the great people of Iran. I mean, how do you even begin to make sense of that? So I thought I'll pick on my friend, an academic, a strategist, a scenario planner. He's an analyst on global affairs, focus on Africa, emerging markets. That's your guy, Rona Kobaldos. Hello, welcome.
Hey, Reddy, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks. We finally get to sit down and speak, albeit under crazy circumstances.
Yeah, it's pretty unhinged. You know, we've entered this this escalation phase of the war. You know, in the past, diplomacy used to be about restraint. It used to be about finesse. Churchill famously once said, diplomacy is the art of telling someone to go to hell in such a way that they ask for directions. and Donald Trump has adopted a completely different playbook. People call it WrestleMania diplomacy, where it's strength through spectacle. It's about emotions, not facts. And it's about attacking posts via social media. And, you know, it's a very different and new playbook that we're operating with. You know, if you've studied the art of the deal, Trump's playbook, he has three rules. It's attack, attack, attack. Never admit that you're wrong. And even when you're wrong, claim victory. And I think that's what we're seeing here with regards to the current situation. It's a case of escalating to de-escalate. The unpredictability, the bombasticness, the rhetoric, all of this kind of stuff is to kind of create the fear and this unpredictability and potentially then back down, as we've seen consistently throughout the almost 40 days of war.
I just want to talk about the impact of that, because it is political and deliberate as far as I'm concerned. I mean, there are people who would dismiss it as just innocuous. He's just crazy. You know what he's like. But that's a strategy. He is doing it for political reasons. Mm. There is an end game here. What is it?
Well, I mean, the end game, I think, is, you know, it varies kind of every day, depending on who you speak to in the administration. At first, it was regime change. Then it was kind of, you know, reducing Iran's nuclear capabilities. Then it was, you know, suppressing them militarily. I think what's quite clear is that they thought this would be a quick Venezuela-type job, quick and dirty, in and out, and they've underestimated the Iranian regime. Now, you know, there are three questions that will determine how long the war lasts, whether it becomes international and regional, and I think that's obviously what Iran's trying to do, what the end game is. And I think there's a disconnect here between the US and Israel. And then I think in terms of the Straits of Hormuz, what happens over there and what that means to global energy markets, right? So the things to watch quite closely in terms of the way Trump behaves is US Treasury yields. When they tick up to 4.5%, he tends to back down. And then gas prices. So as we get closer and closer to midterms, the reaction of markets also, and then missile mass, those three things, I think, are the things to watch quite closely.
Okay, I just want to get back to the kind of leadership dimension. We'll talk the military and the economy. Let's just talk a little bit about the leadership, the tone and leadership. I mean, these blunt, vulgar ultimatums to Iran on social media. You did say that this is not traditional diplomacy that is rooted in de-escalation and finesse, right? I wonder what this moment of having a leader of that caliber, what that signals about the United States' moral stature right now, because it's no longer just Donald Trump. America, I would say, is losing its standing in the world. And even after the midterms, even if it elects someone different after Donald Trump, which they will if he doesn't run for a third term, his strategist or former advisor Steve Bannon is talking about a third term, and Trump also likes to playfully drop those kind of hints. The US will have to do a lot of work post-Trump to repair, restore, and heal the relationships that he has so systematically and maliciously dismantled.
Yeah, I mean, I think trust is the currency that you require to lead. And unfortunately, when you're this unpredictable and inconsistent, it really does a lot of damage. We all saw Mark Carney's speech at Davos talking about the rupture and the new world order. I think what we are seeing, though, is the emergence of an era of international honesty. The mask is no longer there. There's no pretense anymore. The era of American exceptionalism, the shining city on the hill, which was about virtues and values, that's over. I think it's quite clearly about interests, not ideals right now. And America is unapologetic about the fact that this is about money, it's about muscle, and it's about raw power. So in many ways, I would argue Trump is the demolition man. He is the undertaker of the global order that America helped to create, rather than the underwriter. And I think we've entered this new era of international honesty.
Mm-hmm. New era of international honesty. Trump is the undertaker. I really, really love how you have phrased that. But then let's talk about America's rivals, right? Mm-hmm. It's got its geopolitical nemesis like China. Well, Russia used to be, but now they are buddies with Putin. Has Washington, in a way, handed narrative advantage to its rivals? We'll get to the economy in just a moment, but just the narrative. I mean, looking at Iran, and let's also be clear here, there's a repressive government there, a repressive administration, women's rights, LGBTQI, we know all about it. And that is kind of the frustrating thing with the dumbing down of debate, that it's either or, that we can't conceptualize and rightfully condemn one act while also condemning the United States and Israel's unprovoked a war on Iran and the targeting of civilian infrastructure in particular. But if you look at the way Iran has handled this, the way they are communicating, they sound like the rational adults in the room. What about narrative advantage? What are your thoughts there?
Yeah, I mean, the US, I think, is scoring a number of own goals with regards to this war. You know, you've kind of almost created sympathizers with a very repressive regime in Iran, just because, you know, the perception is one of bullying, of unpredictability, of just completely unhinged behavior, where you're bypassing the UN, you're bypassing Congress, you know, you've bypassed every single legal framework in this war, and you know, you've eroded goodwill. And you know, the moral legitimacy then is also under question, because, you know, if you're an architect of a system and you yourself rejected, that brings into question the merits of the system in itself. So, you know, there's a lot that the US has done to kind of erode its moral standing in the world, and question marks around whether it is fit and able to lead, because, you know, you require consistency, you require predictability. And we're already seeing countries diversifying their allegiances, diversifying away from US treasuries and the dollar, because there's a lack of trust in US leadership under Trump.
You used a word, consistency, and we know that in Africa in particular, there's a growing skepticism. There's always been about Western consistency. Even the bilateral relations, they happen because that's how the world works. But with our long history of colonialism, neo-colonialism, you name it, there is skepticism and a lack of trust. I wonder, I mean, you work with a diverse array of clients all over the world, all over who are interested in Africa as well, all over Africa. What questions do they have? How is this moment, maybe that's a better question, how is this moment being read on our continent?
Yeah, so, I mean, like you said, largely countries are shrugging their shoulders. We know about the inconsistency and the double standards across the board, and we have for a long time. But each country is trying to kind of frame its strategic calculus and respond accordingly. From an economic perspective, right now it's about crisis management. The impact of these energy shocks are going to be quite profound. We know how this works. It's sequential, not simultaneous. So what we're seeing in Asia is soon going to come to Africa and Europe. And we don't necessarily have the safety nets and the policy war chests that other countries do. So you've got this trade-off between inflation and the inflation shock versus protecting the population and preserving social stability, and then growth. So, you know, that's the dilemma that a lot of policymakers are wrestling with. The three F words, as I say, food, fuel, and fertilizer. Those shocks are going to be big. We're already seeing countries like Egypt and Ethiopia taking significant protective measures to try and manage the situation. And then from a geopolitical standpoint, you know, in a might is right world where it's law of the jungle, African countries and smaller countries in the global south are affected disproportionately as well, because they actually benefit from having a voice and a rules-based multilateral order. If it's basically a case of the strong do what they can and the weak suffer what they must, then we effectively become rule takers rather than rule makers. And then that sets a very dangerous precedent globally, but also within the continent, because you've got very weak abilities to enforce rules, and then governance structures, which are already not great, come under pressure.
You know, I'm just sitting here thinking, even George W. Bush, I never thought that we would speak about him in that kind of positive comparison, comparative analysis with him and Trump, that even as so many loudly condemned the war on Iraq that was based on a lie, weapons of mass destruction, I never thought decades later we will look at how he went about that war. Even he demonstrated some modicum of regard for multilateralism. He went to the UN, right? He went via the channels here in Washington, Congress, and then also went to the UN, even though we now know his mind was already made up that he was going to go into this war. But there was, as I say, that kind of semblance of normalcy as far as processes are concerned. I just want to stay with the Africa response for a moment. I mean, we're not a homogenous continent. Even as South Africa has a particular relationship with Israel and the US, Kenya will have a different one. Rwanda will have a different one. My question is on this, that we've spoken about skepticism about Western consistency. We keep speaking about a pivot toward multipolarity, but African countries want different things. Or even if they say they want the same things, they go about it differently. And I wonder, for Africa in particular, does economic reality still tether countries like South Africa, Kenya, Zambia, whoever, to the West? And that dynamic will inform how the continent responds. And I'm also thinking about another theme of divide and rule. Yeah. You know, if you have a country that is dependent on the US in a particular way, there's this controversy around health data and these deals that Kenya has made, but other countries have said, no, we don't want to do this. And then Trump will threaten them with all sorts of punitive measures. So those different dynamics, how do they shape this picture?
Yeah, so we've been here before, you know, when great powers fight, you know, we've been here through the colonial era, we've been here through the Cold War, where Africa effectively becomes piggy in the middle, a theater for competition and conflict, and is exploited. This time round, I think we have to be far more pragmatic, far more commercially aware, and far more savvy in the way we approach diplomacy, because it's not either or, it's both and. And as we get these two kind of competing poles, the US on one hand, China on the other, middle powers, established and emerging powers, African policymakers need to be smart around how they negotiate and what kind of deals that they negotiate so that we don't end up as collateral damage in this era of transactional great power competition. So I think that's the approach. Of course, economic realities and pragmatism does need to feature, but in a world where, you know, demographics in Africa, critical minerals in Africa, Africa's diplomatic clout at multilateral institutions matters, the only way we're going to be able to exercise this effectively is by getting our house in order internally and by operating as a collective and speaking with a singular voice. Because otherwise you get the divide and conquer tactics that you mentioned, where countries are taking a very narrow lens, thinking short term, and not in the best interests of the continent. And what that does is that it reduces your leverage. So I think that's the approach that policymakers across the continent need to get right. And to do that, you need the big economies to be seeing eye to eye and firing.
Okay, that's interesting. You mentioned critical minerals, and I just want to talk about that for just a moment, because they've become quite key in foreign policy, in bilateral relations, in Africa's place in the world. And I wonder your thoughts on South Africa. I mean, is South Africa a key player in critical minerals? Do we have some leverage here? We know that the cost of debt, there's an inequality of debt, and there was talk of transforming the global financial architecture, and you know, the global dominance in commodities, all of that. What advantages are we bringing, or what leverage are we bringing to this very changing and fragmented world?
Yeah, so the debate around critical minerals, I think, is framed in two poles, right? You've got climate colonialism on the one hand, where, you know, again, we export the raw material, import the refined product, no value add, no beneficiation, no job creation, versus this kind of sentiment of resource nationalism 2.0. We need to extract royalties, get the benefit of what's in the ground, move away from pit to port, and we want to beneficiate. So those again, are the two extremes, and you've got to kind of come up with a practical way of leveraging the benefits of this commodity windfall. And I think this is where South Africa can play a major leadership role. Of course, you need the right regulatory policies, you need predictability, you need partnerships, and you need pragmatism around how you approach this. But, you know, as we saw with the G20 last year, South Africa can play an important leadership role in terms of multilateral fora, in terms of speaking with and for the continent, and in terms of engaging on behalf of the continent in terms of this kind of resource debate. And so I think that's where the value add can be. The gateway to Africa play as well is something that we've done with mixed success in the past. So I think for South Africa, it's a case of, given our mining expertise, given our leadership expertise on the continent, is coming up with a way that effectively reads the moment, reads the room, and harnesses the benefit in a way that we can benefit from this. And critical to that is creating regional value chains, because not every country can beneficiate. The more you integrate, the more you create regional value chains with specific niches, then I think the more you can become attractive markets, because a lot of the leverage for countries with critical minerals is in the quality of that resource. So you think Guinea with iron ore, you think DRC with its minerals, it's got a stronger hand than many other countries that want to beneficiate. And I think that's pretty essential in framing how we negotiate the benefits around critical minerals.
So I want to talk about South Africa, the US, and Iran. South Africa has been under pressure from Washington over its posture on Iran. There were other countries that they mentioned. And I know that the conversation here on the Hill around sanctions, targeting specific leaders, and we know those executive orders last year, just different foreign policy positions. But Iran in particular, MTN embroiled there and so on, and that also became a foreign policy matter. How do you see this playing out? I mean, is this about principle or just power politics? And where should South Africa position itself here?
Yeah, so South Africa's relationship with Iran goes way back, right? So Iran was a critical supporter of the anti-apartheid struggle after the revolution in that country, and the ANC does not forget that. So there's that historical link over there. Post-94, there was a lot of commercial diplomacy. You've mentioned the MTN example and that kind of commercial play over there. And then there's a third element, which is rooted in a push towards a fairer, more equitable global order, not led by the Western world. So the global South reform of the global financial and economic architecture. So things like BRICS Plus, which both South Africa and Iran are members of. So those are the three things that have kind of anchored the relationship. I think when it comes to South Africa, there's the substantive stuff, which is, South Africa can be friends, allies with whoever it wants to be with, and that's its prerogative as a sovereign nation, right? It's got its red lines and its kind of areas that it's not going to compromise on. But then there's the optics, and I think this is where we don't particularly play the game well, right? So naval exercises when we know that the relationship is tense, military generals going to Tehran on unsanctioned trips, just doesn't look good, right? So I think that ability to read the room is sometimes a bit clumsy, and goes missing. And so, I think that's the challenge for South Africa when it comes to diplomacy. I think multi-alignment, having a broad range of relationships, flexible diplomacy, even ambiguous diplomacy, probably served us well in the current situation, is can be an advantage, but it's more about the how we execute, and the ability to kind of take less moralistic and more pragmatic positions, I think, is the challenge for South Africa's foreign policy machinery.
I've never heard that term before. You said ambiguous diplomacy, right? And it just kind of like, aha, that's the word, that's the phrase. Because one of the things that have made me pull my hair out is our almost juvenile, as South Africa, our juvenile desire to declare that this one is our friend, this one is our friend. We come a long way. Nobody does that for us. When South Africa was being battered by Trump, did you hear? Putin, for whom we have been twerking as a government and a state. Did you hear him? If he intervened behind the scenes, we don't know about that. But he never stood on the rooftops and say, Trump, please lay off South Africa. They are our friend. He didn't do that. Even China, we know there's support because there's those bilateral relations, trade, but nobody's coming out and declaring. But we seem to be the only ones who feel the need, like little children, to stand and say, this is my buddy, this is my BFF, with great consequences for our foreign policy
Yeah, and I
positions.
think that's the thing. We need to update our diplomatic playbook for the current realities. I think it's still stuck in a Cold War era. It's still quite simplistic, as you've mentioned, and it needs to become a little bit more sophisticated and elegant because we're dealing with lots of complexities and lots of nuances. And so we need to understand what our leverage is, when the right time to speak is, and when not. And take the example of countries like India that have very skillfully played the game to its advantage, but understanding what kind of leverage it has and what bargaining power it has. So I think that's the challenge.
I want to give a few more examples of this because I know that people who support the ANC government who have a, or those who have a very fierce anti-American sentiment are going to say, hey, China is our friend, Russia is our friend. Here are other examples. When there was that BRICS summit in Russia, Putin pulled a PR stunt by displaying the BRICS dollar or what BRICS currency. It was a PR stunt. We were scrambling, explaining that no, we're not discarding the dollar. No, we're not doing this. No, we're not doing that. And India just didn't even engage this thing because it was nonsensical as far as it's concerned. So there's Putin using the stage to do his PR and to flex to the Americans. And then China was responsible for organizing those drills, right, where Iran was participating and they were not supposed to. China understands the tensions in our US SA relationship. They could have just deferred the drill in the first place, but they didn't do it. They didn't do it for us. And the last example I want to raise about this, President Ramaphosa had a conversation with Putin a month ago, they were talking about other stuff. They were talking about these matters of Iran and all. But Putin issues a statement that misrepresents the call, says that Ramaphosa expressed support for Russia's actions on Ukraine. And that's not what happened. So you see how we've got friends. We're the ones loudly declaring that we've got friends, but they're playing their own strategic game that doesn't always have our best interest at heart. I just thought I should mention that.
Yeah, I think you're right. So a bit of naivety with the way we approach diplomacy, and we need to become a little bit more streetwise.
Hi, Readiness Report listener. I am the host of the Let's Talk Human Rights podcast. On this show, we talk about real issues affecting people's freedom, dignity, and equal rights across Africa. If you want to learn more about human rights and how it connects with you, then listen in and join in the conversation.
I do want to focus on Iran and South Africa in particular. You've given the historical context, the support for the anti-apartheid struggle, and that the ANC, it's not in the ANC's DNA to forget that, but in modern times, they could frame the conversations and the relationships differently. South Africa frames its relationship with Iran in those lines as global South solidarity. There are some repeated claims that Iran has funded the ANC, yet no credible, verifiable evidence has been publicly produced. And he who accuses must produce the evidence. So you were funded by Iran. Prove to us that you were not funded by Iran. I know that the ANC has had some very nefarious funding experiences with tenderpreneurs who get state tenders and they give some money to the ANC. We've got the Hitachi Metta Chancellor House. We have rightly written and spoken about those matters. But on the Iran issue, what is your understanding of that very massive claim and accusation?
Look, as it stands, it's just speculative. Like you said, the evidence has not been produced. We can speculate as to the reasons behind it. We know that the leadership in the various countries are quite close, and there have been visits back and forth consistently over the past few years. So there's that. We also know there's been a lot of backlash around South Africa's ICJ case. And so it might be a case, if you throw mud, it might stick. But in the absence of clear, verifiable evidence, it's just conjecture at this moment. Might be the case, it might not be the case. I don't think there's any real point speculating further than that.
I agree. I think reality, what we know, is already dramatic enough, and we can work with that. So as we part ways, as we say goodbye, we don't know what the next few hours are going to look like, Ronak. But I do want to remind our viewers again that the President of the United States posted, "A whole civilization will die tonight, never to be brought back." The reaction, I just want to read some of the reactions as we conclude. Some very respected commentators: "This is one of the sickest, most demented, most morally reprehensible, most disgusting things any American president has ever said." And there is another post from an editor who says, "These are the ravings of a homicidal maniac and sociopath, and you voted for him not once, but three times." Addressing obviously those Republicans who did vote for him. So, Ronak, as we conclude, I don't know what the world looks like in the next few hours, but maybe you do. You can tell us. Closing comments.
Yeah, I obviously don't have a crystal ball, but I think, you know, we are in an escalation phase of the war. I think this is textbook Trump. He is going hard and going balls to the wall. But we know that he has a history of kind of moving deadlines, being unpredictable. Markets have tended to think that he's going to taco, in keeping with Trump always chickens out. The stakes are extremely high here. And, you know, when you've got maximalist actors like Iran, like Israel, the GCC states are looking for an off-ramp. Trump, despite the bluster, is looking for an off-ramp as well. I think, you know, this is all part of the negotiating playbook. I think the war will continue to escalate for another 6 weeks, 6 to 8 weeks. But eventually it will get to a point where a diplomatic solution is probably the only viable outcome. Mm. That said, we're dealing with an egomaniac, and the size of Trump's ego is huge. So there's that element of unpredictability. But I think this is kind of needs to be read in the context of the current phase of the war and the escalation dynamics.
Ronak Kopaltas, thank you so much. I mean, you are so busy. It's been so difficult to pin you down. You're traveling. I never know which part of the world you're at. I suspect you are in the UK, and then I blink, you are in China. I blink, you are in South Africa. All on politics, economics, business in Africa. Director at Signal Risk. Thank you very much for talking to us.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. That's the Readiness Report, guys. Stay steady, drink your coffee, and take a breath.